name is Tina, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. It is such an honor to be here. I feel extremely privileged. And I want to say that I have been to many conferences. And you guys have the best energy at any conference I've ever been to. Some wonderful people since I have been here. Got to hear Danny's story last night, and I enjoyed that. Got to meet his wife Cheryl. And the time since I have met them, I realize that I want to be like them when I grow up. I really admire them, and I mean that. Thank you, Doug. Dave, sorry. I knew this was going to happen. Just give me a minute. It's okay. You know, I want to welcome the newcomers. I see that we have some newcomers here. And I want to, man, I couldn't have came here to a conference like this when I was a newcomer. And I want to say that if you don't relate or understand the terms or the terminology, or if you cannot pronounce the words like anonymous or anonymity, welcome, because I couldn't either. And I'm so grateful. You know, I've been sober since August the 22nd of 2000, and I am so grateful. You know, I would like to say that I got sober at 18 years old when I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous, but that's just not my story. You know, I had to go out there for another, I got sober at 34. And all I know is that it takes what it takes. What we're supposed to do is get up here and share our stories from our own language and from our own point of view, how we established a relationship with God. And I'm to share with you what I was like and what happened and what I'm like now. I'm getting hot now. I want to tell you that when I got here, there was no power greater than me except for the law enforcement. I was facing 25 to 99 years, and I was scared into desperation. You know, it was a hard journey before getting here. But I am grateful for so many things, but to have finally learned how to live this way of life is so amazing. I am so grateful. I have a life beyond anything that I could have ever imagined, and I have a life that I truly don't deserve based on my actions. And it's a privilege to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it. You know, whether it's making coffee or picking up someone at the airport or showing up to share with you my experience, strength, and hope. So what I'm going to do is share with you what I was like. I believe I wasn't given much of a chance at life, and I was born into a family of chaos. And the only thing that I saw in that family was sex, drugs, and violence. And at 2.5 years old, I was introduced to some natural herb. And I don't remember that, but my grandmother says I ran and got on my rocking horse and I just started rocking away. I must have liked the effect produced by it at 2.5 years old. You know, and I don't remember that, but I do remember being 4 years old and and enrolling it myself and ingesting it, and that became a way of life for me at a very early age. My father, he died from an overdose when I was 3. And I only remember a few things about him, but my grandmother tells me, your daddy loved you. You were daddy's little girl. And as a child, all I know is that I wanted to be loved. And my mother was addicted to the same thing, and she was not capable of showing any love, any emotion whatsoever. And at any time, I never knew when she was going to die. So what I was like, I was terrified. I was terrified to be inside the home. You know, the weapons that were inside the home sure weren't for anyone outside. You know, I never knew what was going to happen. But I don't know if I was more terrified to be inside the home or outside the home. Because, see, if you guys knew what it was like inside my home, you wouldn't accept me. And I had to go to school. And I don't remember anybody ever mentioning it, but looking back, I can see that I had a learning disability. And I never felt okay in school. Not only was I full of fear and I didn't feel okay in there, but I couldn't learn. I couldn't retain anything. And so while the other kids were out playing PE, I was up in the auditorium with my natural herb. And believe it or not, I found 2 or 3 other kids just like me. And that's how I lived. The first chance I could, I quit school. So I want to tell you that I have a 7th grade education, and I was a straight F student. Where else can I say that but Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, one of the 9-step promises says, we will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. All I know is that I lived throughout my life until I got here just wishing my father were alive. I thought if my father were here because he loved me, I would be okay. He would fill that big hole, that emptiness I had within me. And I wanted something from my mother that she was not capable of giving. And so I dwelled in that pain. I would go there constantly thinking about him or going to his cemetery just to relive that pain over and over and over. And at 15 years old, I was at a party, and I remember there being a whole lot of Tanqueray gin. I didn't even like it, but I sure drank it. And probably drank it until I was in the state of an unconscious blackout. Well, that night I got pregnant. So a couple weeks later I find out I'm pregnant. And the only thing that occurred to me was, I'm going to have this baby because this baby's going to fix me. This baby is going to love me unconditionally. See, the book tells me that I suffer from selfishness and self-centeredness. And so when I look back, I decide to give birth to a child because I am so self-centered. It is about what you can do for me. And I just wanted to feel whole. Now, I want to tell you that I know I was introduced to alcohol way before, you know, at an early age. But looking back, I mean, I was picked on a lot. Kids that suffer from low self-esteem and are wearing dirty clothes to school and coming from the family that I came from, you're picked on a lot. There's a lot of cruel kids out there. And one of the things, I couldn't stand up for myself. I was just terrified. But this one particular night, I think I was 13 years old, I drank before I went to the skating rink. And there was this girl, and she was like, she reminded me of a bulldog. And she picked on me a lot. But this particular night, I drank, and something different happened. And she came up to me, and boy, I kicked her ass. And I'm going to tell you, I knew from that moment on that alcohol did for me what I could not do for myself. See, it gave me power. It gave me courage. I could stand up to you. I could do anything on alcohol. So that's what I'm going to talk about is power, because that's what I've been looking for all my life. And alcohol did many things for me. You know, and I ended up giving birth to my son when I was 16 years old. And I want to tell you, I wasn't drinking at the time, but that was my first spiritual experience. I had natural childbirth, and he was beautiful. And I love that baby, and I wanted to be a good mother to him, and I wanted to love him and give him everything that my mother couldn't give to me. And I meant that with every part of my being. He was 5 months old, and I was pregnant again with my second child, and I wasn't so excited about that. But I give birth to her. And within 3 months, my grandmother, I ended up leaving the marriage I was in. My grandmother steps in. She's the queen enabler. And she stepped in to help me parent my children, and boy, I was off and running. Back then, the legal drinking age was 18, and I was hitting the bars. And I never drank like other people. I'm the type of drinker that it was all about power, right? So I am going to outdrink you no matter what. And I also like to drink and drive. I go out to the bars, and the people that rode with me would try to fight me for my keys, but they were not getting them. It's all about control. And so at 18 years old, I leave the bar. My friends don't ride with me, but I ended up running a red light, hitting a car. Could have seriously hurt some people. And that was the first time that I was arrested in my first DWI. And while I'm in there, you know, I start coming down off of the alcohol, and all I could think about are those babies, how those babies need me. And I get out, and I don't want to do the same thing again. And that's when I was sent to Alcoholics Anonymous for the first time. But I remember walking into the rooms, and the main thing that I remember hearing was the mention of God. And that completely turned me off. See, I viewed people that believed in God as weak. And remember, it's all about power and control for me. And so I didn't continue to go. But the book tells me that I suffer from the disease, that I have lost the power of choice, and that my mind is going to forget the pain, the humiliation, and the suffering from even a week or a month ago. I am without defense against that first drink. That's telling me that pain and the stuff that I was feeling while I was in there and how I wanted to live, very quickly my mind forgets about that. And then I seek out the ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a drink. So I get out and I start doing what I do. At 19 years old, I was, you know, if you're an alcoholic like me, and I highly respect the singleness of purpose, but anything that I put in my body, I do it alcoholically. And I was introduced to cocaine at 19 years old, freebasing. And I was just doing what they did. I wasn't even interested in it. And I don't even think the first two times I did it right, but the third time I did it, I must have done it right. And there was no stopping it. Within 6 months, I had my first two delivery charges. And now I have these cops telling me that I'm going down for 10 years. And all I could think about are those babies, how those babies need me, and how I love them, and I really want to be a good mother to them. And I make a deal with them so that I'm not going away for 10 years. And I get out, and I'm supposed to make contact with them. I mean, within 3 days, I'm not making contact with them. I don't follow through with the deal that I'm supposed to do. And there I am, off to the races again, doing what I do. And see, when I do what I do, I abandon the things that I love. I abandon everything and everybody, and I will do whatever it is that I need to do to get what I need. So when I hear people say, oh, the love of my family, man, the love of my family is enough for me to stay sober. Or they get sober and think, you know, for this or for that. See, if you're a real alcoholic like I am, given sufficient force, there is nothing. See, I have lost the power of choice. There is nothing. Fear of dying, fear of losing my children, fear of going to prison for life, it's not enough to keep me from picking up that first one. I wish it were. Man, I would have stopped a long time ago. So I was on the run for about 7 years. And I couldn't stop. I don't want to be living like that. But there was no way out. I didn't know how to live. And it was a horrible way to live. Anytime a helicopter would be flying over, and this is, you know, I just knew they were coming to get me. It's all about me. You know, the book tells me our problems pile up on us, and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. Man, I didn't know how to deal with life, and I really wanted to live right. I want to tell you, when I'm drinking, this is what my drinking was like. I am a blackout drinker. I'm a violent blackout drinker. And I walk in, and because I'm so uncomfortable with me, whatever it is, that I destroy anything in my path, and I hurt whoever is in my path. And I was very emotionally abusive. And I know I saw and experienced things that I shouldn't have experienced, but I also did the same things to my children. And I carried a whole lot of shame around that. Because, see, that's not who I wanted to be, but I didn't know how to be any different. And I was living, I'm the type of alcoholic that I say I'm going to the store, I'm going to go get a loaf of bread or maybe a six-pack of beer, and I don't show up for a week. And I don't come back home. You know, and there's been a Christmas to where, Christmas Eve, I was going to make it home because I was Santa Claus and I need to be able to put out the toys for my kids. And I sit there and watch the sun come up on Christmas Day because I cannot stop. Many of times I was done, and I have been in and out of treatment, and I have been in and out of jails. I mean, this disease takes us to three places: jails, institutions, and death. The last place that I want to be, I'd rather be dead than to be living locked up. And fear of those consequences are never enough for me to not pick up again. You know, one of the times I was locked up for a year and a half, and the last 9 months of that was in treatment, in prison. It's called safety. And I'm telling you, I was done. Seriously done. And I still didn't know what the problem was. I thought the problem was the alcohol and the other stuff. You know, but I get out of there, and I am willing. I go to meetings. I am willing to go to any lengths. And I went to meetings. And I got a sponsor, and I worked some steps. I don't remember her ever picking up this book, though. And I remember getting to the ninth step, and I started to feel better. I started to experience the promises. I was sober another year on the street. Then I was diagnosed with cancer. Within 2 weeks, I've been having a 15-hour surgery. It was very extensive. And they put me on some pain medications. And prior to that happening, I told myself, I'm not going to abuse them, and I'm not going to allow myself to become addicted. See, I was still clueless about the first step. I still have control. And I took one pill a day, every day for 6 months, until I picked up the drink and it took me. See, I was still controlling it. I thought if I'm only taking one pill a day, I mean, it was a serious surgery. I had muscle removed and I was in intense pain. But see, I was still controlling it. I wasn't taking them as prescribed. And what it really was doing, every time I took that pill at 5 o'clock, it was giving me a sense of ease and comfort. And I was off to the races again. My disease is so powerful that it really, really takes me down, and I go into the underground world, and I do anything that I can to take care of what I need to do. And one of the times while I was in my disease, my son, he was 15 years old, and he was about to turn 16, and he was living in his own fear. He wasn't... He had gotten in a little bit of trouble, and I asked him to meet me at this particular location on his birthday so I could take him back to my grandmother's. And I showed up, and it was his birthday, and he wasn't there. It's down on the drag in Austin. And so I asked some guys, I'm like, have you seen Dylan? Have you seen my son? And they said, oh, he took off with a group of guys. They went to hop a train. And I was devastated because, see, I knew I wasn't the mother that I needed to be. And there went my baby that he's taken off to Vegas on a train. And I was driving around in all this misery and pity. And then I get a phone call. They told me that he had fallen off and fallen under that train. And I couldn't handle that information. You know, it's like, how am I going to handle this? What happened? Is he dead or alive? And they told me he survived the accident, but it amputated his arm. And I couldn't handle that. I couldn't even go into gratitude that he's alive because, see, I suffer from self-centeredness. All I could think about, I briefly thought about him, but what I mainly thought about is how I was going to handle this. And I show up to the hospital, and I'm looking at my baby. He's not a baby, but he's still my baby that needs me so desperately, and I can't even hug him because I feel so toxic. And I can't even stop doing what I'm doing, and I have to keep going to the bathroom because I cannot stop doing what I do. And I leave that hospital because I have to have some more, and I plan on coming right back. But see, when I leave, I don't show back up for a week. And he gets released and gets sent off to detention. And I'm going to tell you, I didn't want to live. I wanted to die. And I don't know why I'm still here, but I am here. And I can't tell you how many times I've been arrested. I should have brought my rap sheet to show you. But all I know is when I got here, I was facing 10 to 99 and 25 to 99 years in prison without any chances of freedom. I've been on probation or parole or both at the same time since I was 18. And I could never get off because I could never stay stopped. I suffer from a disease that wants me to drink and that ultimately wants me dead. I suffer from a disease that destroys lives, destroys families, separate families. And so I take this very serious. So when I say I am so grateful to have finally learned how to live this way of life, I mean that with every part of my being. In 2000, I was arrested for the last time. I was locked up for 3 or 4 months. And I finally get out on a ankle monitor. You know, they didn't even want to let me out because I was considered such high risk. I'm out on an ankle monitor, and within the first 24 hours of my release, I am drinking again. And I didn't plan on that. And I did that for 12 days, and I just wanted to die because I could not deal with the consequences that I was facing and how I was living. And when I went into treatment, I didn't really go in there because I wanted help. I went in there because I wanted the consequences to stop. And what I really wanted was to wake up and realize that my life was just a bad dream. I could not face the fact that I am facing 25 to 99 years without any chances of freedom. And I really wanted the pain to stop. I really wanted to die, but I was still here. And I go into this facility, and I just wanted to sleep. And then I started to wake up. And this group that was inspired by some of the people I highly respect in Texas, by Chris R. and Mark H., one of my mentors that has recently passed away, they started carrying a message to me in the treatment facility. A message unlike anything I ever heard. And it was a message out of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they were talking about me. They were talking about being restless, irritable, and discontented. And they were talking about a solution. And they were happy. And see, it wasn't a solution of just don't drink for today. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days and you'll be okay. See, me, I go to meetings and you guys bore me. Meetings bore me. You know, but today I know something different. There are some meetings that bore me. And if they do, then I am responsible for bringing the solution. There are solution-based meetings where they're out of the Big Book. And by the way, my home group is Carry This Message in Austin, Texas. And the topic does come from out of the 164 pages out of the book. And it's about current experience with this work. So it's very much into the solution. But I'm going to tell you that while I was in treatment, something happened, a miracle happened, and I believe that was my first step experience. I finally started hearing this thing about an allergy, that once I put it in my body, I can't stop. See, I carried so much shame because I couldn't control it, because I couldn't stop once I put it in my body. And I started understanding that I have this disease, that I have a mind that tells me it's going to be different. I'm going to be able to control it and enjoy it, and my body shows me something differently. And I'm going to always have that. But what I got more than anything else was the second part of step one. And that my life is unmanageable. And I'm not talking about the legal stuff. I'm talking about this inward unmanageability. All my life I have been a prey to misery and depression. All my life I've been full of fear. I want to tell you that when I got here, I had so much self-centered fear that if they would have told me that I'd be here standing in front of you, I wouldn't have came back. I could not pronounce. When I got here, I couldn't pronounce the words. I couldn't do the readings. You know, yes, I was uneducated. But I know I'm not stupid. But see, when I got here, I really thought that you guys wouldn't accept me. I thought if you knew where I came from and what I was facing, that I didn't even think you would accept me. I thought those of you who had been around for a while were free from defects of character. We're perfect. See, today I know the truth. So I had that first step experience in there. And I was facing those consequences. But I became willing. See, the book says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I'm going to tell you, I didn't believe it would work for me because I had never passed any test. And I had failed everything except mastering you guys out there on the streets. So I really didn't think it would work for me. But see, I had this willingness. And I was willing to go to any lengths. And I'm going to tell you that even after 10 years, I am still willing to go to any lengths. And so I get out of that facility and I started to see how I was paralyzed or driven by fear all of my life. And so, man, every time I would get in my head, I would think about that 25 to 99 years. Oof. If I would have been driven by that fear, I sure wouldn't have been sober. I probably wouldn't have stayed in Austin. You know, I would have been off somewhere where they couldn't find me. But I just became willing. And so once I understood the hopelessness of my disease and that there was a solution, it really didn't matter what the future held. I was really staying in the moment. And when they say get on your knees and pray, it doesn't matter what you believe. Do it. I did it. When I first got here, we would circle up and we would say the Lord's Prayer, and I would cringe. But I became willing. And then that started to go away. I became open. In the third step, we make a decision to turn our will, which is my thoughts, and my life, which is my actions, over to the care of God as I understood them. Well, I didn't understand them, but see, before I got to the third step, it tells me, isn't it funny how the only time we talk about alcohol is in the first step? See, we don't take alcohol through the steps. We take ourselves through the step. See, it tells me that selfishness, self-centeredness is the root of my problem. Then I'm driven by the 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. See, I'm a habitual felon because I am selfish and self-centered. So simple. But when I was coming all those years, I didn't have anybody telling me that or helping me. It's like, I don't know, either I was missing it or they didn't know anything about this book. Because I'm going to tell you, this book has the answers. And I remember hearing them say this book is meant to be studied as a text. Like I said, that intimidated me because I didn't have any studying skills. But I was willing. And I surrounded myself with people who were carrying the message to me out of the big book. So in the third step, it says we make a decision. And I made that decision. The book also tells me it will have little or permanent effect. It's a vital and important step. But will have little or permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in me that caused my failure. I was willing. See, I was surrounded by these people that wanted to get me through these steps quickly. They wanted me to start sponsoring people. Well, I wasn't interested in that. And before I got through the steps, they were pulling me into the treatment center. And I get out and they start pulling me in and I start carrying the message. And the book tells me that nothing, absolutely nothing, ensures immunity from drinking as intensive work with others. See, I was hoping that if I really got sober, the judge would see it. Although my attorney kept saying, man, you know, Tina, the DAs, you know, the DAs. I mean, I had a year sober before I saw the judge. And my attorney saw this woman that was transforming, but he still knew I was going down. He said, the DAs aren't giving in. You know, they looked at me as a drug dealer, not as an alcoholic. But that's because I was one. Oh, man. I had so much faith at that point that I patted my attorney on the back. I said, David, I said, don't worry about it. God's in control. He flipped. But at a few months sober, I mean, I was seeking to connect to this power. And I was working, you know, and I was working these steps. And somebody handed me a rock. I just shared this. You know, and a friend of mine gave me this rock. It has a stamp grape on there. It says, love is a verb that requires action. See, God started talking to me through that rock. And I looked back at my children and the people that had been in my life and said, did my actions show that I love them? And I was practicing this prayer and meditation, and I started hearing a God. I remember hearing people say that they heard God, and I thought these people were crazy. How do you hear God? But I started hearing thoughts that were unlike my own, and one of them was, you're not what you think you are, and you're not what others think you are, that you are a perfect child of God. And I started from that moment recreating my life based on that idea, not my idea. And I also heard, Tina, if you focus on what the real problem is, that you are so selfish and so self-centered that your actions don't show that you love those children unconditionally, that you'll never spend another day in jail. And I believed it. But it wasn't just about the children. It was about all of you, all the people. Do my actions show that I love you? Or do I just throw you away when you challenge me? Well, that's my default setting. You know, you're riding in the car with me and you're challenging me. I'm pulling over and you have to get out. I mean, that's the truth. That's the way. That was my default setting. I didn't know how to deal with anything. And I'm so driven by my own delusion and my own fear. That's how I dealt with life. So what started happening was I started to experience these promises. And I was able to be alone at perfect peace and ease. And any time fear of those consequences would come to me, I would go back and get centered. Either God is everything or God is nothing. And I saw the judge at a year sober. He said, something's happening in this woman's life and I'm not going to send her to jail. And I haven't spent another day in jail. What was happening is I started driving to these halfway houses and started caring about, I didn't really care about you guys, but I was doing it. I was going to the treatment center and carrying the message, and it wasn't really that I cared about you guys at that time. It was because when I walked out of there, I was on this spiritual high. See, it was still all about me. It was the way it made me feel. And then I started going because it was my duty. And then something shifted some point down the line to where I truly started caring about your life. That if you guys are suffering from a disease that I'm suffering from, it is trying to kill you. And I will do everything in my power to help you understand the fatality of that and to get you through these steps as quick as possible so that you can have a spiritual awakening and experience some of these promises so that you can be in the recovered state. But what a great place to be in the recovered state, be in a place of neutrality, safe and protected. Couldn't drink if I picked it up and thought I could. You know, I mean, that is a wonderful place to be. So what life is about. So that's some of what's happened. What life is about. I mean, at about 5 months sober, I had a sponsor that told me to raise my hand to start sponsoring others. Well, that freaked me out. See, I had nothing. I don't know how I'm going to help you. Don't you know who I am? And see, and then I had all these ideas that if I start sponsoring, that I'm supposed to be like a counselor? Your life coach? I know I'm not skilled for that. I am not qualified for those roles. You know, and then I went to all of these ideas. I learned that we operate from all of these ideas and roles. See, then I thought it was my place to let all my family members know that they had a problem. And that there was a solution. Oh my God. That is not my place. And then at some point in sobriety, I thought I was a psychiatrist. I needed to tell you about what mental illness you had. You know, and I know a lot of us go through the same thing in sobriety. And it got to a point where I realized then I became very angry with the psychiatrist because I sponsor a lot of women. And I see many people that are on these different medications and they just can't get the deal. They can't, they're not clear enough to be able to go through this work to have the awakening so that they could be in the recovered state. I want to tell you, in the 10 years that I have been here, see what the book says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I see that never has a person failed who has thoroughly followed our path. And I see many people, and I've seen many people, we lose them. Either I'm showing up to the funeral, or they're back in prison. A very dear friend of mine, just 4 weeks ago, I mean, she started drinking again, 52 years old, flipped her car, she was running from the police, and here she is, her fourth CWI. She's in prison, and going to prison again. It's like, dang it, you know? But so many people come in and want what we have, they try to get it by osmosis. Let me just hang with you long enough. But what about that destruction of self-centeredness? See, a price must be paid, destruction of self-centeredness, to have this freedom, to have this gift. This is a gift. If you guys would have told me that the highlight of my life would be when I get to show up to my commitments to the treatment center, I wouldn't have believed you. If you would have told me that I would truly care about your life, somebody that I barely know, I wouldn't have believed you. If you guys would have told me that I'd be sponsoring a doctor, I really wouldn't have believed you. You know, thank God I don't get what I deserve. And sometimes, I mean, I know that I have a God that loves me so much, and His miracles have happened in my life, and sometimes I still doubt my worth. And I don't think it's by any chance or it's any mistake that I am here tonight. See, really, they wanted my sponsor here. And something happened, and she felt inspired to send my talk. You know, and it's like, this is the first time that I've been flown out to speak to a group of people. And I am so honored. I am free of shame. I want to tell you that my mother is still alive. But she cannot go a day without drinking. She's probably going to die from this disease. And my mother is very isolated and secluded in her own little world. And I've always wanted to be loved by my mom. You know, I want on my birthday or some holidays, I want my mom to call me, but she still can't. And so in my first year of sobriety, you know, I did the step work, and she hadn't been a part of my life, and I wasn't able to make direct amends, so I sent her a letter, and she didn't respond, so I sent another one, and she still didn't respond. And it was okay, and I started to become free, though. And it wasn't until this last year that I got to make direct amends to my mother. My mother's the woman that has never shown any emotion. And see, what's different this last year, I got to see on a level that I wasn't able to see in my first year, was that my mother is still very much an abused woman. She can't show any emotion. And when I made direct amends to her, I saw tears come down her face. She has cirrhosis of the liver and hepatitis C and can't go a day without drinking. See, it's not about what my mother can do for me anymore. It's about what I could do for her. See, my purpose is to love her unconditionally. And she was open after me making those amends to go out on the lake, and I got to take her out on the boat with me. I really got to see how sick she was, but it wasn't about all of that. It's about how can I spend some time with my mother? But that's just one of the miracles, one of the gifts. That I can't do on my own. That shift that's taken place in me is from a power greater than me. The IRS, I want to tell you that back in the day, I got to tell you guys about this. One of the times, you know, I filed my income tax and claimed my children, but somebody else claimed them at the same time. And I remember getting a letter from them, but I was drinking and I just could not deal with it. But I got a letter and they wanted that money back. And so I get sober and I had so much fear that I could not deal with the IRS until I was 4 years sober. And I finally had the courage to pick up the phone and call them and have the willingness to make it right. And when they answered the phone and they looked it up, they said, "You don't owe us anything." Yeah. I said, "Somebody took care of that." I don't know who took care of it, but I just know I didn't have it. You know, and I've so many things. I want to tell you that being a mother has always been very important to me. I was about a year and a half sober, and this little girl was brought into my life. And I want to tell you that she's 9 years old today. And she was 6 weeks old. She came into my life, and I got to participate in co-parenting her. And that little girl has never seen me drunk. I have never slapped her. I've been a stable member in her life. Never pulled her hair. All the things that my daughter had experienced with me. And so what God did for me was allow me to be able to grow and be a parent to another child without the attachment of it. When I first got sober, I went to work at Goodwill. See, I had no car. I lose everything. I'm in a halfway house and I go to work at Goodwill. I mean, you know, where else are you going to go work if you're a habitual felon? And I was there for a few months, and then I decided to go to work at Home Depot. But I lied on my hiring application. Anyway, I got hired on at Home Depot, and I was there for over a year. Miracles were happening in my life. You know, the judge had set me free, and I was in the process of getting promoted. Man, I was going to make a career at Home Depot. I loved it there. And during that process, I had to sign a release for them to do a credit and a background check. And they saw that I lied on my hiring application. I was instantly terminated. Here I was a year and a half sober, and I was devastated. I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And I went through a couple of days of just depression and staying in bed, and then I come into the rooms. Man, you guys pull me together, and someone told me, man, when one door closes, another one opens. I want to tell you that I've been a business owner for 8.5 years. And if I would have tried to plan that, I couldn't have done that on my own. I don't have to fill out applications anymore for people to judge my past. I'm a homeowner. See, from where I come from, you're not taught that you grow up and you become independent and you buy a home. And I'm not taught that. But see, so I've been placed in this position where I don't have to fill out applications for people to judge my past. Sponsees. My sponsor is Katie P. from Austin, and she's been my sponsor for about the last 4.5 years. A couple of years prior to that, the sponsor that I had moved away, and I was on self-sponsorship, and I was seeking help from strong men in Texas, but you know they weren't my sponsors. No, I mean that. I mean that in an honest way. I couldn't find any women. I couldn't find any women in the area that were carrying the message. See, I don't need that gentle approach. I need someone to tell me the truth. They see something, and so I like the way that some of these men would. They didn't care about my feelings. They care about my life. And so when I was seeking help, because I need that, my life, this is about my life. If you care about my feelings, you're going to keep me sick. So in the meantime, I was also sponsoring myself and grading my own paper. And I don't recommend that for anyone. And then I found Katie. And at about that time, I was sponsoring about four or five women. And she said, if you believe that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of your problem, you need to have at least five that you're working with. Well, at that time, I had four or five, and I may have been getting two phone calls a week. I said, oh, no, I need at least 10. I need at least 10 so that I've got someone calling me every day. I didn't know how I was going to do that. It's like, you know, we think about how are we going to fit this in? You know, how am I going to do this? Well, see, me on myself, I can't do that. But when I take this into prayer and meditation, then God makes it possible. So now I have a meeting at my house on Wednesday nights where I bring people into my house. That's one of the things. If you grew up in the home I grew up in, it takes a while before you open your house to people. We're not used to that. And the healing that's occurred, it's taken a long time for me to even be able to laugh, like a deep belly laugh. Open my house to others. The healing is still happening. 5 minutes. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. The highlight of my life is helping others. And I want to tell you that there's nothing. Commitments. This is what I heard early on, and I believe it. There's only one good reason for missing a commitment or canceling a commitment. And that's that you died on the way. It saves my ass. I'm going to read out of a vision for you on page 153. It says, it may seem incredible that these men are to become happy, respected, and useful once more. How can they rise out of such misery and bad repute and hopelessness? The practical answer is that since these things have happened among us, they can happen with you, should you wish them above all else, and be willing to make use of our experience. We are sure they will come. The age of miracles is still with us. Our own recovery proves that. I am not the miracle. Alcoholics Anonymous is. And I want to tell you that today I am a mother. My son, he's 28 years old. He's still only his arms cut off up here. But I'm going to tell you, he looks at me as his hero. And he works for me. And I have a decorative concrete business. And you should see him operating that buffer with one arm. You know, my daughter, my kids are so proud of me. But they felt the way that I felt around my mother. You know, I was an embarrassment. And they disgusted me. I mean, my son told me not too long ago that he used to fear when he'd hear my Mustang pull up in the driveway. They feared me coming to the house. You know, that's who I used to be. But now they are so proud of their mother. You know, I am a friend. And I have friends. And it's not just because of what you can do for me. It's about what we can do together. And we do help each other out. But see, before it used to be just about me. What I can gain from you. I'm a sponsor. And most of all, I try to remember that I am a perfect child of God, and that means I'm going to make mistakes. And see, all I have is a daily reprieve, and I keep coming back here, and which I don't do perfectly, but if I live in an active 10th step, do my prayer and meditation, my nightly review, and work with others, then I have a life. I'm not fighting anything or anyone. I am at peace and ease, and I get to experience the promises. And all you have to ask yourself is, if you're new, if you're struggling, is if you want more than what you have, there's always more. And grab somebody that's in love with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you can have it too. Thank you so much for my recovery.
hotel staff for trying to keep up with our crazy asses. So,
what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.